Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear oral argument for petitioner in Hatley v. Texas A&M University.
Justice, justices of the court. The issue, as the appellant sees it, is fairly clean. It's whether or not Texas A&M University, at its installation in Galveston, as a branch of the executive government, can claim to be irresponsible to the Constitution, the state of Texas, through the doctrine of sovereign immunity. Interestingly enough, a case against Texas A&M University on state constitutional issue was litigated in the 11th District Court of Harris County this past summer. So what we did there is may fall by the way or stand by the way, depending upon today. The fact that this lawsuit arose in March 1990 out of events that occurred in 1989 when a tenured professor in engineering, Dr. James Hatley, was resigned without his consent and told to, in effect, vacate the premises.
How's this a free speech case? What did he say or want to say?
The pleadings that we must take as true in this case, because it is a plea of the jurisdiction, indicates that Hatley and Slota were having academic disagreements. Slota, who is no longer there, was came in the fall of 1989 as the director of engineering. When Hatley then expressed to his president, vice president, and the director of TAMUG that he had not resigned and that his relationship with the institution had not been severed by his choice or by his will, at that moment they shifted and said, well, nevertheless, we're moving in one direction and you're moving in the other, and his was out the door.
I just don't think that's free speech. How's that a free speech?
Well, in Texas, my view is fairly doctrinaire, I think, with the language. Any matter upon which a person expresses themselves is protected, and government can take no action against an individual because of their expression on any matter. That's the contrast with the federal standard, which is more restrictive and says that only matters of general public concern are protected. I think that Hatley had an opportunity to engage in protected expression when he voiced his opinions, when he ventured into a discussion with Slota. The subject of that has not been explored because we didn't get past the jurisdictional issue. He had an opportunity and he had a right to disagree with Slota's conduct and action in peremptorily breaching the relationship or severing the relationship that he had with the Texas A&M University.
Could he have filed a 1983 action?
A 1983 action was filed. And the 1983 action still remains, interestingly enough, somewhere in the vestiges of this case. Whether it's an action that has meaning or not, probably, because 1983 perceives that the state is not a person within the context of that federal enactment.
Where does that claim remain in the framework of this particular suit?
Unaddressed by the trial court.
Still in the trial court.
As a practical matter, the trial court, on July 28, 1993, when the trial court dismissed all claims against Texas A&M University on the basis of sovereign immunity, presumably dismissed that one as well. all is kind of an all-inclusive word.
What about the cases that suggest that if an agency through its officers acts outside the Constitution, that you need to sue the officers directly and not the state? The state can never act.
I think you have an that's based upon, as I understand it, Your Honor, the presumption that which is a fiction, I think, that the state will never do anything wrong. We work on that fiction through the presumption. And if you have an officer who's acting ultra vires, then that's not the action of the state. Here you have the action of the state. Here we're not asking for a restraining order. We're asking for a mandatory order. We're asking that the other contracting party to the relationship that Hatley enjoyed be ordered to reinstate Hatley.
Why couldn't you sue Hatley's superiors and ask for mandatory relief against those superiors reinstating him, as opposed to suing the university?
I think when you sue the university, when you sue the box of the agency, you sue all the authority and the power within the box. If I were to sue the individuals, I would have to be asking that they individually put Hatley back to work. They couldn't do that. They are not. They don't have the authority in the state. So in order for them to be able to put Hatley back to work, I have to sue them in their official capacity. If I sue them in the official capacity, that's a suit against the state. If I sue the state, I dispense with the unnecessary nicety, I think, of bringing in individuals. I don't think that it's necessary to sue individuals in their official capacity to do the act of the agency, and the agency itself can be addressed.
You did sue them to start with, isn't that right?
They were sued originally.
Were you counsel for Mr. Hatley then?
I was not original counsel.
But then they were non-sued, is that right?
I non-sued.
What relief are you asking for this court?
It's an interesting thing what happened. They originally were sued. Okay. The agent...
I'm past that now. What are you asking this court to do?
I'm asking this court to declare that the trial court of Texas has jurisdiction over the state of Texas through its agency and the executive branch, at least, Texas A&M University, at Galveston to deal with constitutional allegations. We believe here that we have a clear case throwdown on whether or not Hatley had a protected property interest.
For injunctive relief only, right?
For injunctive relief only. For declaratory, equitable relief. For declaratory, injunctive relief.
Well, can we take it that you concede you don't have an action for monetary damages?
I concede that under Beaumont versus Bouillon, we don't have an action for tort damages.
So that gets us to the equitable relief. Did you preserve the equitable relief you're asking for in the Court of Appeals? And if so, when and where?
We never got to the point of relief. The trial court said it had no jurisdiction and it had no ability to exercise the right to speak over the party, Texas A&M University. Consequently, if it has no right to speak over any issue, it has no right to speak over a part of our claim, which would be the relief. So consequently, if there is no right to speak about the party, there can't be, in my view, any right to start saying, well, but wait a minute, let's start nitpicking on what relief we might have available.
Well, would you agree it's clear from Bouillon that you don't have monetary relief by tort damages, but you do have, at least in dicta, a certain more equitable relief?
I think that it's clear from...
So what more can you get?
I can't get any...
In the context of any lawsuit.
What we have here is a case about principle, I suppose, the way it boils down. Did they do right or did they do wrong? And all we can get under Bouillon is the equitable relief.
When and how did you preserve your complaint about equitable relief? In the Court of Appeals, please.
Well, in the Court of Appeals, we never got past go. The Court of Appeals, what we had was...
Well, they can only act on the points of error you bring to them. Is that correct?
I don't think that they can consider what relief is available to a party that they don't have jurisdiction
of. They can only act upon the points of error you bring to them.
That's right.
Did you bring a point asking about equitable relief?
No. We filed this lawsuit.
And how can you raise that point for the first time here?
Well, of course, the case was submitted to the Court of Appeals before Bouillon was decided.
Well, how can you raise it here for the first time?
Because we're dealing with an issue. You don't, as I see it, I don't get to Baltic Avenue unless I pass go. I got stopped on go.
How have you passed go as far as this court is concerned?
Because the trial court has jurisdiction of the state of Texas.
How does this court have jurisdiction of the assertion you're making before it is today?
This court has the power, I think, to decide whether or not the state of Texas is sovereignly immune to the Constitution of the state of Texas. It has the right to decide whether the creature is greater than the creator.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's assume that for certain procedural reasons you were unable to proceed any further on your equitable claims. What claims do you have remaining?
No. But I think that if we take the two points, that one that's been addressed, the trial court said no jurisdiction. We said to the appellate court, we do have jurisdiction. The trial court did have jurisdiction. The appellate court said, no, he didn't have jurisdiction. Besides that, you can't get damages anyway, so you don't have jurisdiction over the party, and you don't have jurisdiction over the claim. Now, the trial court ignored, I think, the other aspects of relief. Now, the question comes back, does the trial court have jurisdiction? And if we go back, can the trial court give any type of equitable relief? Surely, the trial court can at least have a declaratory judgment there as to whether or not my client was done right or my client was done wrong.
So what you're saying is it doesn't matter if you were seeking equitable relief or damages or whatever, the issue before us is whether or not the trial court had jurisdiction to consider any claim.
Absolutely. I think that we're somewhere between Beaumont and federal science. I think that the court has to decide whether or not that in Texas, governmental agencies created by the Constitution are amenable to constitutional violations before to be litigated or at least decided by the courts of general jurisdiction of this state at the trial level.
Mr. Watts, if a claim for equitable relief exists under the law against the state in these circumstances, can the state claim immunity from prosecution of that claim?
I don't think so.
Why not?
Well, because that would mean that the state is irresponsible to the Constitution of the state of Texas, and I don't think that it can be. I'm a little theological in that view, and perhaps a little even a sort of fundamental rightist, but I don't believe that the creature can ever say that it's as great as or equal to the Creator. I think what we have here is an Adam versus God type of situation. When you say to government, which is created by the Constitution, that you are immune from being responsible to the precepts of the Constitution, even though we have a high and mighty Constitution, and it's wonderful, and it's vigorous, it just doesn't keep you from getting off the reservation. Then I think, in effect, what you're saying is that Adam is equal to, if not superior to, the Creator. I just think it's very simple. I understand that the problems. I think this court is wrestling for the first time, probably, in the history of this court, with the true meaning of individual rights. And I think that in this particular case, we have an opportunity that may come back to you about these individual rights and remedies. But right now, I think we have to go back to go. Does the trial court have the right to speak about constitutional violations of the agency of the government?
Any other questions? Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument and respond.
May I please the court? Ms. Sarah Anderson will present argument for the respondent.
May I please the court? I think this case is very clean. It's a very simple issue, whether or not a party can recover equitable relief as against the state agency directly. whether you can sue a state agency directly when there hasn't been any kind of waiver of sovereign immunity by the state legislature. And I think the answer to that is clearly no.
Do you think that we can get to that answer, or do you contend that there are certain preservation problems?
Your Honor, I correctly thought that he had briefed that point in the Court of Appeals, and I think that's a very interesting question that you all have raised today, and I think it probably deserves some further briefing, and I'm going to go back and look through the record and see if I can brief that story for
okay.
you.
Let me ask you this. What is the purpose of our Bill of Rights, our being the Texas Bill of Rights?
The purpose of the Bill of Rights is to place limitations on the acts of state officials.
State officials. Where do you find in the Bill of Rights that it's a limitation on the actions of state officials as opposed to the state?
Well, you have to go back to the theory behind sovereign immunity. That is, the king can do no wrong. And if you use Mr. Watts' analogy of the creator and Adam, The state is the creator. The state is not Adam. The state is the creator. Adam, the created, is the state officials who are placed in a position where they may abuse their authority. They may abuse the authority that the state gives them. And the state constitution is the vehicle which places limits on that authority. And under City of Beaumont versus Bullion, the state constitution is the vehicle that you may use to sue those individuals, those officials who have abused their authority.
So if I understand you correctly, the Texas Bill of Rights in no way places any limitation on the government, only government employees, or those who otherwise are cloaked with state action?
Well, the government can only act through its employees. There is no great computer system that is the government. The government can only act through its employees, and its employees are the individuals who, if anybody does, abuses their authority and acts to deprive citizens of their constitutional rights. That's why the individuals are the ones who have to be responsible for that.
Who should he have sued? Who should he have asked the court to direct injunctive relief against?
He's actually sued the people that he should have sued. He sued the president of the component institution, which is Texas A&M at Galveston. He sued the vice president for academic affairs. He sued the dean and the chair of the department. He sued those four people. And those four people clearly would have had authority had he properly served them and pursued his claim and won on the merits of a declaration that his rights have been violated. Those individuals would have had the authority to put him back to work.
What about his argument that he could only sue them in their official capacities, and when you do that, you're effectively suing the state?
Well, the ex parte Young fiction, which this whole doctrine is based on, says that if the state official has acted ultra vires, that is, outside the authority that the state has given him, then you can sue that official for the equitable relief that you need. And the way this works in federal law is you sue the official in their official capacity. If on the merits that official has not acted outside the scope of his authority, and that's usually determined by summary judgment, then that official has sovereign immunity. If on the other hand, on the merits, the official has not acted outside the scope has acted outside the scope of his authority, did I get that backwards, then the court can order equitable relief. And the court has an official there to hold in contempt, for instance, if the official doesn't perform it.
Well, that gets us back then to square one. And that is, if I understand what you're advocating, and that is that as long as state officials are acting within the scope of their authority, then they are cloaked with official immunity and cannot be sued.
Well, official immunity is usually said to apply to a state official who is acting in a state official suit in his individual capacity. Sovereign immunity is the type of immunity that applies to a state official who is sued in his official capacity who has not acted outside of his official capacity.
And so when someone is acting in their official capacity, they can't be sued as an individual, even though when acting within their official capacity, they may be violating the constitutional rights of someone else. They may be crossing the line of the 29 Bill of Rights that we have.
If you assume, hypothetically, you've got a state official who's acting unconstitutionally, you can get to that state official in two ways. You can sue them for common law, under some kind of common law tort. For instance, in Bowl versus Campbell, which the court cited in the Bullion opinion, you had a common law tort of false imprisonment. So you can get to them for, in their individual capacities, for money damages. And the defense that they may raise is official immunity, that is, acting in good faith within the scope of authority. You can also get to that state official by suing him in his official capacity under the Texas Constitution for the equitable relief that you seek, such as reinstatement or something, due process, something like that.
And what's the authority for that?
The authority for that is I think, basically that you've got to be able to pursue equitable remedies under the state constitution, same as Ex parte Young.
So we yet have no authority for that in Texas.
I'm sorry?
The last proposition that you stated, there is yet any authority on that.
I think that it's judge-made authority under Bullion, City of Beaumont v. Bullion, just as Ex parte Young was a Supreme Court case that was decided in order to give citizens a way to recover the relief they needed to from state officials.
What is the allegation of constitutional deprivation? What occurred? What's in the pleadings by Mr. Hatley that demonstrates that his constitutional right of free speech has been violated by this termination?
Well, I don't think there is anything. We don't get to that, as Mr. Watts conceded. But if he had served the president, the vice president for academic affairs, the dean, the chair, and we were back in the district court, and he was saying, I deserve equitable relief in the form of reinstatement because you violated my free speech rights, what I would have to do to defend them would be to go in on the merits with a motion for summary judgment and show that all he did was complain about the actions that the new chair was taking here, and that's not a protected speech.
Is that the only thing that's in his pleadings?
I believe that's it.
It's just that he had a difference of agreement with his chairman of the department, and he was terminated.
That's it. Yes, it was a new chair, and he instituted some changes, gave him a different teaching schedule, things like that.
Are you asking the court then to follow the Ex parte Young model with respect to this type of action under the state constitution?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think this court has followed the Ex parte Young model in the past in Cobb versus Harrington, which is a 1945 Texas Supreme Court case, which is cited in my brief. It's directly on point, explains the purpose behind Ex parte Young, and holds that will apply in the state of Texas for all the reasons that the United States Supreme Court has applied Ex parte Young to this day and continues to. So there is a Texas Supreme Court case on this. I should inform the court that there have been recently a couple of cases that are not cited in my brief. One, Harris County versus Going, which is at 896 Southwest 2nd 305, and it's a writ denied case out of the First District in Houston, which agrees with my position. In that case, there had been a trial against Harris County as well as official defendants, and the official defendants, the jury found, didn't do anything wrong, but the jury found that Harris County had done something wrong, and the court ordered Harris County to provide equitable relief, and that was reversed by the First District on this very basis, that it was only against the county. And the county is not the proper party to provide equitable relief.
Ms. Andrews, let me, on that point, you mentioned the king can do no wrong. Maybe the king can. What is wrong? What is wrong in the facts of this case where an individual terminates, Mr. Haley's been terminated, an individual did it. That individual may or may not be personally liable for their actions. It all kind of depends if it was their official capacity or their individual capacity or in their scope or without the scope. But why wouldn't it be the better course that if you're seeking an injunctive relief against an agency's conduct, I want my job back, that you simply name the agency and let the agency pick the person who would be ultimately responsible for that to be the representative of the agency? Why, what purpose does it serve under this fiction, as you've described it, to require Mr. Hatley to try and figure out if he finds the right person to be named so that the ultimate relief can be granted, and if he fails to find the right person, that then somehow the agency doesn't have to respond?
Well, I think that's a very good question, and I think there are some very good reasons behind this theory. And one, I think the first and foremost reason is it offends the dignity of the state. I think that the state, as an entity, should not be sued and alleged to be a bad actor, i.e., the state tramples on people's rights. Now, agency officials don't particularly like to be named as bad actors, as people who trample on state citizens' constitutional rights, but I think that's the appropriate way to do it. Now,
But you could name for an agency official who's a bad actor. You could name them. And they're responsible for their own acts, I suppose.
And that's what you should do.
But why does that mean that the state shouldn't be named as a bad actor in terms of? If it's an agency policy, and we're just trying to figure out who it is that's making these kind of policies.
If it's an agency policy, you name the head of the agency, and this is done all the time. Cases are filed all the time naming heads of agencies, sometimes along with the agency itself, and frequently the defense of sovereign immunity on the part of the agency may not be raised. Because in the long run it doesn't make any difference because you do have the head of an agency or some other official in authority to order to provide the relief. If you look at the United States Supreme Court's opinion in Alabama versus Pugh, which was cited in my brief, you also see another reason why the courts frown upon naming the agency or the state as a defendant, and that is that you don't have somebody to hold in contempt if they don't do it. In other words, you don't really have good stick to hold over them if they don't do it. Whereas if you have the head of an agency in front of you and you order that head of the agency to change his policies, you have somebody to hold in contempt if they don't do that.
If that's the only problem, though, why shouldn't we just remand this and let the other parties be named?
The other parties were named, Your Honor, and were non-suited. At this point, I think that the statute of limitations has long since run. This happened in 1989. It happened over 8 years
back.
Ago.
You don't think it relates back?
I don't think it would. I don't think that's the purpose of the statute of limitations. I think that at this point, I don't think they could add them back in. He should have served them. He would have been he would have been able to assert his claim for equitable relief if he had served them. And I should probably point out that he didn't actually have the claim for equitable relief pled until after the hearing on our plea to the jurisdiction. He filed it 6 days later. If this had been a summary judgment motion, he wouldn't have been permitted to do that. The district court did rule based on all the pleadings on file and said there was no way that he could recover either equitable relief or damages against the state agency.
The contractor were working for the university building facility and got into a dispute with the university about the work that was being done. Could that contractor sue that official at the university for an injunction prohibiting the termination of the contract or breach of the contract or prohibiting the interference with the completion of the work? Would that violate sovereignty?
I think that's a different question and one I'd have to give some thought to before I answered that. When you're talking about a breach of contract action, of course, the state has sovereign immunity unless it's been specifically waived. The question of whether you could get an injunction, that's an interesting one.
Well, we're very close to that here because there doesn't seem to be much free speech involved. And so the next question is just tenure. Just did they force him to resign in violation of his contract with the university? So it's pretty close.
I think that you would have the same problem that you've got that we've been talking about, i.e. that sovereign immunity would protect the agency and the agency officials as long as they were not acting ultra-virus.
But if they're breaching the contract, they're acting ultra-virus.
If they're breaching the contract, presumably they would be acting ultra-virus, although they are parties to the contract.
So this business about sovereign immunity of the state for suits on contracts really is not quite as firm a bar as you think, that you could get around it by an injunction.
Well, but you still don't have the state officials that you need in this lawsuit. They were non-suited out.
But if they were in?
If they were in, I think that would be a different question. But they were not in. He chose not to serve them, and then in order to make the record completely clear, he chose to non-suit them. Are there any other questions?
Anything else? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I'd like to correct a couple of points. Number one, a moment ago when Justice Baker asked me if I preserved discussed on appeal the issue of remedy, I did. That's at page 4 in the petition for rehearing. I'm sure that it probably is in the appellant's brief. But in that particular part, it's the first paragraph that starts under argument authorities, where I say in plaintiff's second amended petition, plaintiff sued under Article 1, Section 8, 1929 of the Texas Constitution. In that pleading, plaintiff asked for injunctive relief in the form of reinstatement to his former position as professor, damages and attorney's fees. Despite this amended pleading, the trial court issued an order granting defendant's plea to the jurisdiction. And the next point is the question that Justice Enoch ask and follow up on what Justice Heck asked. And I didn't speak accurately to you, Justice Heck, and I apologize. When you asked me about free speech, I was so muddled on my sovereignty issue, and I had so come here loaded for that bear that I forgot to talk about the cub of the petition. But in the pleading, which we were allowed to expand upon by the court's order, if you look at the pages 18, 19, 20, of the second amended pleading, which was permitted by order on July the 28th, 1993, you're going to find that we talked about the other speech issues directly specifically. We laid out, for instance, that Hatley protested SLOTA's racial prejudice against Chinese professors, specifically one Dr. Wang. We also laid out in there specifically that SLOTA was prejudiced against Russian professors that were coming in to work during the summer. We also pointed out in there that SLOTA intended to avoid and sidestep rules of admission and was going to enroll a student in the university in spite of and regardless of the admission rules. We also talked about, Justice Enoch, two other constitutional parts. This case is clearly constitutional, not only on free speech under Article 1, Section 8, but also it's clearly a due course of law, because we're talking about property interest and liberty interest. In fact, the property interest, and that's sort of a parallel pattern for the federal analysis, says that in this particular case, we had a tenure relationship. We had a written agreement, not like my Brown case, which was here before, but we had a written agreement between Texas A&M University and Dr. Hatley, which said that he would not be terminated except for good cause.
Why is it not a mere breach of contract case?
Well, because I think that it has, that the whole setting aside of that, they didn't tell him, Justice Gonzalez, that we're going to breach the contract. What they did was they said, we're resigning you. We're accepting a verbal offer that's been reported to us by SLOTA that you made 2 days ago or 3 days ago to him that you resigned. He said, I didn't do it. So it's not that clear. It's a little bit of avoidance. And I'm sorry that the state feels like it's an offense to its character to be told that it sometimes is a little careless with its constitutional obligations or with its moral duties.
What about the argument? Who would you enforce an injunction against A&M against? If you said A&M reinstated, they didn't do it, who are you going to say?
Keep in mind that if the ex parte Young model, the only reason we have ex parte Young is because we have a federal anti-injunction statute. Now, in particular, we are dealing with, and by the way, states have been sued since the outset. Remember, Chisholm versus Georgia in 1793 is the reason we have the 11th Amendment. But in this particular case, we say sue the university and university reinstated. How is that handled in the federal court? I can think about a case that's in your books. It's called Thomas versus Sams in the city of Prairie View. There the city of Prairie View was ordered, of course you have a federal statute that says, or a federal view of the law that says federal judges have the authority to do whatever it takes to enforce their judgments. But there the city of Prairie View, Texas, was sued. Federal judge in Houston, Sam Lake, ordered by mandate that the city of Prairie View City Council, which was not a party, sit down and pass certain statutes or ordinances and levy certain taxes taking care of certain obligations. What you do is you simply order the university. We serve the university through Atkinson College Station. The university is capable of responding. The Kent University is capable of doing that which the court tells it to do. As to where the individual defendants went, let me point out that when we came to the case, I thought that the individual defendants had been served. So did they. In December of 1991, they filed a motion to substitute counsel for the state defendants, plural, defendants, not one. Not once did they say state defendants, but several times. We operated on that basis. When Judge Lerner said, I don't see where they've been served, and suddenly the Attorney General says, well, we certainly aren't going to voluntarily appear for them. The point was made.
Was an answer filed on their behalf?
Other than the substitution counsel?
Was there an answer?
There was a plea to the jurisdiction filed by the university alone. That took care of the university, and that took care of the individual defendants and the official capacities.
Did you seek service on the individuals?
I'm not prepared to answer that. I cannot tell you what. I just don't know.
You don't know whether or not you sought service on the individuals?
The case was in someone else's hands. I moved into the case about 30 to 45 days after the lawsuit had already been filed. I was admitted to represent the plaintiffs in June of 1990.
But after that day, you took over.
We assumed that they were there because there was an appearance made. But the point is that it's one of these heads I win, tails I win deals. If the state says, well, you've got to sue the individual defendants in their individual capacity if they're trespassing, then the state wins because it's not responsible. But besides that, how do you get an individual defendant to put Hatley back to work if you sue him in the individual capacity because he's ultra vires? Yes, ma'am.
What if the trial court does enter a mandatory injunction against A&M telling them to put Mr. Hatley back to work and the university doesn't do it? How does the trial court enforce that order?
Well, the...
Who is held in contempt? How is it enforced?
I think the way the trial court would handle it would be to have a hearing and to determine why the order was not carried out. In the city of Prairie View...
Well, but who would it be enforced against? Would the trial court hold a hearing and say, now who is the individual who works at A&M who's responsible for putting him back to work, and then hold that individual in contempt? You couldn't do that with the individual not being a party to the order.
In the private world, corporate defendants are fined frequently. Microsoft right now is dealing with that same issue. I think that
the order is enforced by fine, as opposed to...
I think that the order is enforced by finding out why it's not been carried forward in the example.
But then what relief can the trial court order once it makes a determination that the order has not been abided by?
I'm tempted to say that I can't believe that the state would get so offended so easily would not abide by an order. But nevertheless...
You're telling us the state violated the constitutional rights of this individual, and you're asking us to let him sue the state for equitable relief. And I'm just asking you to, in terms of the follow-through on this, what's going to happen if A&M does not do what the trial court...
I think it would be an order directed. I think that the A&M would appear through the chancellor who was served, and the chancellor who would serve on behalf of A&M would do that which is necessary. I'm not quite sure. You know, the courts have held, this court held, in the Hayden Company versus Doggett back in 58, that in effect... where you would impose contractual liabilities upon the state, it is a suit against the state. I think that in Federal Sign, for example, that the disbursement wasn't sued by Federal Sign, but that's not the reason the lawsuit failed. The lawsuit failed was because in that case, a non-constitutional case, you had a particular issue as whether or not the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, which made available certain steps to go to the legislature to beg them to get permission to sue the state to have it do what it said it was going to do in the first place, wasn't followed. So I think that in this particular case, in response to that, that the court can carve some order or some judgment that would give effect to what it does or what it says should be done. It won't do a frivolous act. All I'm asking you to do is to please let me wrestle with that issue with the court. Send me back and let me have the fundamental issues here, more important than remedy, excuse me. The fundamental issue here, as I see it, is whether or not the state of Texas, through Texas A&M University or the University of Texas or any executive or legislative branch, is responsible. I thought that y'all held that it was on constitutional issues. In the Commissioner of Agriculture and Environment versus the Printing Industry Association of Texas. I thought that that's basically what was held, that you don't need consent to go for constitutional judgment.
Any other questions?
I apologize for the
long. That concludes the argument. The second case will take another detail.